My aim here is to give a kind of basic introduction to how to read Aquinas. This is actually a rather pedagogical introduction to thinking with Aquinas on a basic subject, on a very difficult traditional question, which is one that we might call the motives of the incarnation, the question of the motives of the incarnation. And the idea of the motives is the question of why would God, as it were, intend to become human if you take the Christian traditional Orthodox creed as a basic given. Why would God intend to become human? And what is the divine plan, the divine intention, intelligibility, wisdom, goodness associated with that? And there's a lot of deep thinking about this in the Christian tradition, even up to contemporary theology. And in the High Middle Ages, there's a lot of really kind of profound reflection and deep argument. Yeah? So I'm going to trace out some of Aquinas' basic answers to this question. And it's a way of exploring something obviously very distinctively Christian, that is to say, the idea that God became human, and look at the inner intelligibility of that claim. Now, just a couple more methodological introduction thoughts. There are three parts to the Summa. If you use the Latin terminology, which Thomistic nerds always use, it's the prima pars, the prima secundae, the secundae secundae, and the tertia pars, which means the first part. The first part of the second part, because that's really fat, the second part of the second part, and the third part. And where we are right now is, where we are in the installation, is in the third part, in the very first question. The third part of the, so in the first part of the Summa, Aquinas treats the question of God and the Trinity and creation, creation of human beings. In the second part, he looks at, it's huge because he looks at the structure of moral action. It's all of his moral theory, his theories of grace, virtues, and vices. In the third part, he looks at Christ and the sacraments. So, in the third part, he begins with the question, and the order is always very important for St. Thomas Aquinas. I didn't say who he is, but I'm presuming people know he's a 13th century Dominican scholastic doctor of the church and a very elevated mind in the Western intellectual tradition. He starts with the question, why did God become human? And then he's got a lot of sub-questions, and I'm sort of throwing us into that by going to one of those second sub-questions here. Was the incarnation necessary for salvation? Now, another final methodological point. This is theology. This is, as it were, what he sees as scientific reflection on divine revelation. Which means if you ask the obvious question that a lot of us modern people would ask, is why do you believe there's an incarnation? Aquinas would say, because God has revealed it and has given us the grace to believe it, and we are allowed to believe it by consenting to it in faith. He is most clearly not saying, nor does he believe, that you should believe in the incarnation, that Jesus Christ or Jesus of Nazareth is both God and human, based uniquely off of deducing that uniquely from premises of natural reason. He doesn't think you can prove mysteries like the Trinity or the incarnation by your natural powers of reason. He's quite a sophisticated philosopher in his own right, but he sees this as something that's been given us to know by divine revelation, and we can talk maybe, if people are interested in the question and answers, about what would be motives for taking divine revelation claims seriously, which I think there are some very good ones. So it's an a posteriori reflection on the mystery of the incarnation, given that it has been revealed. All right, so God has revealed this, and now we're looking at the intelligibility. So it's not an attempt to argue from premises of natural reason to the reality of the incarnation, but from the givenness of the revelation of the incarnation to see its inner intelligibility. So it's, that's why it's a science of theology. You're looking for inner kind of grounds, explanations, intelligibility within the revelation. So what I'm going to do now is just go through. I've chosen out a few articles. I'm going to spend the most time on the first one. And I'm just going to go through a few of them and read them with you and comment on them. And now this may seem to you like really strangely pedantic. I could have read this on my own. But this is what we do in the Dominican order often when we teach Aquinas. It's not all we do. We don't just sit around and read Aquinas. But but you can actually spend your time doing there's a lot worse things you can do with your intellect. Because actually when you sit around and comment on him and discuss him in community, you start to think about what the inner argument is, and then it allows you to build bridges to engage with more ancient and more modern figures. But one of my, aims here clearly is to make the Summa Theologiae this is from the Summa Theologiae, to make that less intimidating and more accessible. Okay, so I'm going to start with this second article in the first question of the third part of the Summa Theologiae. Was the incarnation necessary for human salvation? Now, of course, Thomas immediately distinguishes. I answer that a thing is said to be necessary for a certain end in two ways. The end is our salvation. First, when the end cannot be without it, as food is necessary for the preservation of human life. That's very straightforward. You need to eat or else you will die. Secondly, when the end is attained better and more conveniently, as a horse is necessary for a journey. In the first way, it was not necessary that God should become incarnate for the restoration of human nature. That may seem to you uncontroversial, but he's disagreeing here with St. Anselm in his book, Cur Deus Homo, which was written in the 11th century. It seems to be taking a different tact, which we'll talk about a little bit more. For God, with his omnipotent power, could have restored human nature in many other ways. But in the second way, of it being more conveniens, in Latin, convenient, it was necessary that God should become incarnate for the restoration of the human nature. And then he quotes Augustine. Okay, the first thing to understand is one of the main differences between Dominicans and diocesan clergy in the 13th century was that as an exercise of mendicant poverty, Dominicans did not ride horses, but walked everywhere. It's thought that Thomas Aquinas walked something like 10,000 miles in his life from place to place. So when he asks a room of Dominicans, when he says to a room of Dominicans in the 13th century, is it necessary to have a horse to go somewhere? It's latent with a lot of meaning. It would be, you know, it would be like if I said to you, well, it's to get from here to Manhattan, it's necessary that you have your own private helicopter. That would be kind of the evident like analogy for us, right? It's necessary in the sense that it would get you there faster, but like nobody has one. So he's talking to so he's saying to them, it's fitting, it's more expedient, but obviously God didn't have to do it. So there's a very strong emphasis on divine freedom. God could have done things very differently, just like you don't typically ride a horse wherever you go. Now, the word conveniens should be mentioned briefly. We do get the word convenient from this Latin word, but really the better translation, the more apt one, is fittingness. Conveniens, an argument from conveniencia is an argument from fittingness. Now, fittingness in medieval Italy, it means something kind of all the way from in a really beautiful, lovely way to, like, in a very expedient, efficient way. And it has lots of registers of connotation. So what it's saying, he's saying is, on the one hand, God really didn't have to do it this way. God did not have to become human to save the human race. But there's something beautiful and fitting and profound about the way he did it. You say, well, beautiful, fitting, profound, that sounds kind of aesthetic and vague. Okay. What he's saying is, he's tracing it back, his argument is he's being traced back here to what he believes about the nature of God, or what we might say the attributes of God. So on the one hand, God is all-powerful, God is very mysterious for Aquinas, we don't know very much about God philosophically, but we can say God has the power to create the world and sustain it in being, and so God is in some way all-powerful, and he's free. God didn't have to create the world, God doesn't have to become incarnate. And so there's freedom and omnipotence in God, and so God doesn't act by coercion, as if he consulted a higher moral law than himself and felt compelled. I'm alluding to like the Euthyphro problem in Plato. But on the other hand, Aquinas doesn't think that the exercise of God's free prerogatives is arbitrary. So conveniencia means God does it freely, and you might say in his serene omnipotence, but God also becomes human out of his bountifulness and his wisdom, his goodness and wisdom. So it's not arbitrary freedom, right? So if you think about other figures he's sort of talking to here, he's anticipating someone who comes after him, who is Occam, on kind of God's capacity to do whatever he jolly well wants to, and it will be good because God jolly well wanted it to be. And he's saying, well, the free initiatives of God are emanations or expressions of God's wisdom and goodness. So it's, you can't really think about God's freedom without thinking about God's wisdom and goodness as motivating aspects. But then against Anselm, clearly, I think, who was writing, you know, before him in the 11th century, 10th century. He's saying, 10th and 12th century. He's saying to Anselm, so Anselm argues that God really needs to become incarnate if he's going to save us. So, like, if we're going to be saved, God's going to really need to commit to this means. It's just the helicopter. Otherwise, we're not getting to Manhattan. Right, so God actually had to produce a helicopter. I'm sorry to vulgarize a little bit, but anyway, there you go. So, I mean, the idea is that it's neither absolutely arbitrary, nor is it necessary. It's beautiful and fitting. So that's the prelude. Why is that important? Because then what we're going to see is all the sort of reasons he's going to give are reasons that sort of show the numinous bountifulness of God, or the numinous kind of wisdom of God. And he's going to give 10 reasons why God became incarnate. And he's going to say at the end that this is not exhaustive. So the first, you know, thing to take away from this is, for Aquinas, the effects of grace in the world are pregnant with a kind of intellectual richness that is not exhausted by a single human perspective. It's not perspectivalism in the Nietzschean sense, like there's just lots of arbitrary perspectives of different people by the according willpower or something like that. He's saying there's like lots of compatible, wise reasons that God does things, but you can't sort of, as it were, give a single reason why God has become human and then you're done with it. There's a kind of depth that has to be acquired, a depth perspective that is acquired through us looking from multiple angles. Okay, so now he goes on and he puts, in effect, two tables in place. And I've got them in bold. Each of the five reasons that come under them are arranged under a kind of heading. And he says, there are two kind of general reasons God became human. One, for our furtherance in the good. And the second, which is on the next page, because of our withdrawal from evil. Now, this is very interesting if you work a little bit in atonement theology, or if you've kind of traveled a little bit through the pages of, you know, modern Reformed Calvinist theology or something. It is interesting that the first perspective of Aquinas is going to be on our furtherance in the good. So he doesn't start with God became human because we are sinners in need of redemption. He is going to say that. But he starts with the fact that it's kind of God becomes human to unite us with God. That's basically the bottom line. Now, the pedigree of this is, you find it most auspiciously articulated in the 4th century by St. Athanasius of Alexandria in his little book on the Incarnation. There's two major works that precede Aquinas on this in the tradition. Athanasius is on the Incarnation. God became human so that we could be united with God. And Anselm in the West, in the 11th century, God became human so as to justify us or restore a fallen human race to a right relationship with God, a relationship of justice and of freedom to do the good. Okay, so the first theme you might call Athanasius's divinization theme. God united us, himself to us, so that we could be united with God, or if you like to use a classical term, divinized. And Aquinas sets this argument out in terms of something he takes from St. Paul, where St. Paul says that the greatest of things are faith, hope, and love. If you've worked at all in theology, you know that those are called the theological virtues, the virtues of faith, hope, and love, that you can acquire divine, supernatural faith, infused hope, infused love. This is not human belief. If you tell me, you know, the talks at 7:30 on that floor of the philosophy building, I put good faith in your word, that's natural human faith. If you tell me that God became human and I believe you, for Aquinas that requires a special grace that God gives you, the grace of supernatural faith to believe God and to know God's truth by a kind of enlightenment of the mind. Hope is an exercise of the will that allows us to desire God and place our confidence and hope in God as a kind of principle of happiness and salvation. An aspiration for God is what we receive from hope. And love is charity. A kind of bond with God elucidated from the heart or inspired in the heart by which we can really rightly love God with the love that that Christ himself possesses, that Christ allows us to participate in his love for God by grace. So what he does then is set these three out as the way that we undergo rapprochement with God. But you'd say, well, okay, I could have faith and hope and love in God who reveals himself to me without an incarnation. I mean, that's what you would believe about Judaism, right? If Paul had remained Saul, he could have had faith, hope, and love in the God of monotheistic God of Judaism who revealed himself to Israel. He wouldn't need an incarnation. So Aquinas is going to talk about how the incarnation is sort of related to the logic of growth in faith, hope, and love. So he says, first, with regards to faith, that which is made more certain by believing God himself who speaks, which is made more certain by believing God himself who speaks, let's say in the human condition, like God by becoming human interpolates faith much more directly, right? So to believe in God through prophecy given to inspired authors or thinkers is different than believing in God who is himself human and speaks in the human condition. Secondly, with regards to hope, which is thereby greatly strengthened, since Augustine says nothing was so necessary for raising our hope as to show us how deeply God loved us, it may not be a conventional subject of university conversation, but there are people plagued, I don't want to shock anyone here, I'm a Catholic priest, so I see this a lot, there are people, very ordinary, reasonable people, plagued by the idea that they have done things wrong for which they cannot be forgiven. And they suffer from often senses of guilt or shame or a sense of poor moral self-worth or the hope of forgiveness. And Aquinas is saying, well, the argument about whether that forgiveness is possible is an argument that is over because God has bothered to become human. So that like really nourishes hope. It, like if God bothered to become human, then God probably is interested in me. I mean, it makes the universe very personalistic, admittedly, right? God is engaged enough with personal, rational agents that he's taken on our human form. And thirdly, charity, which is enkindled by this, and Augustine says, what greater cause is there for God's coming than to show God's love for us? I hope that raises a little question in your mind. If God loves us so much as to become human, why is there so much, you know, ridiculous amounts of evil in the world? Okay, we'll hopefully come back to that a little bit at the end. Then he gives a fourth argument, which is from example, that Christ, by God becoming human, shows us how best to be. God is the most human of us all. Right? So Jesus of Nazareth shows us in a certain way how to live a most human life. And finally, he comes to this, he states overtly this divinization theme. Fifthly, with regards to full participation in the divinity, which is the true bliss of man and the end of human life. And then he quotes Augustine, actually, with the same idea as Athanasius. God was made man that we might be made God. Now, that's not to be taken literally in the Christian tradition. Augustine does not actually think literally Christians could become the deity, but rather they might participate in God's own life of beatitude, participate in God's happiness by knowing God and by loving God. Okay. Then he goes into the withdrawal from evil. First, he talks about the devil. Aquinas is a classical Christian, believes in angels, including fallen angels, and that there are invisible powers of evil in the world. So he's saying that because God showed, this is a kind of solidarity theme. Theologians talk about a solidarity theme in the atonement, that God shows his solidarity with us as people subject to a world in which there are a lot of vicious evils by taking on our human condition to show us how we may, through our own perseverance and moral righteousness, overcome the powers of evil in the world. And allied with that is the second argument, which is from that the incarnation shows us the dignity of the human person. It's a very interesting, just in case, just like a notable thing you might not be aware of, but it was rather interesting politically, is that when John Paul II was elected Pope, his first encyclical, Redemptor Hominis, the Redeemer of Men, Redeemer of Human Beings, uses this very argument from Aquinas here to say that if God has become human, then no governmental system may have a total competence over the dignity, the exercise of freedom and intellectual life and the dignity of a human being, because God has created an alliance with the human person in the incarnation, which shows you a dignity that transcends that of the state. Evidently, he's talking to communism in his native country, Poland. And it's just a very interesting, I find it interesting, just as you know, in terms of historical theology, you have an idea from the Middle Ages that a modern pope took to the heart of the solidarity movement in
articulating kind of motives for resisting what he considered to be a totalitarian system. And actually, it was very effective. That claim that Christianity recalls the dignity of the human person over and against some problematic forms of political absolutism. Then he talks about the fact that it shows us that we have no merits that precede our receiving friendship with God. It shows us that we should be humble. Man's pride, which is the greatest stumbling block, can be convinced and cured by humility so great. And then he concludes with quoting Augustine and Pope Leo, so 4th and 5th century figures, on it's really the seeds of Anselm's argument. Now, I'm going to just summarize it, and I'm going to summarize it badly because Anselm's argument is very subtle, and you just have to kind of oversimplify if you're going to do it in passing. Basically, Anselm argues something like this, and Aquinas believes this. He just believes that God did it by kind of fittingness rather than necessity. The human race has fallen into conundrum. We have a spiritual destiny. We're somehow meant to be related to God and to each other in charity and truthfulness. We fall into pretty serious moral conundrums. We are relatively alienated from moral righteousness in regard to one another. At least sometimes we certainly trip up and we have some very important social and political ills that assail us. But we're also deeply alienated from God to the point where we often don't even know God. Consequently, we need to be, as it were, ontologically repaired from within. But at the same time, we need to have a rapprochement with God who is infinitely just and good. And so we need a principle within ourselves that would allow us to have a rapprochement with God of justice that is infinite and kind. Because God is infinite. Like when we offend God, we in some ways alienate ourselves from a principle of infinite justice. So how would we have a fully human salvation come from within the human race that has a kind of infinite dignity or infinite justice to it? Well, only if God himself, who is infinite in his dignity and infinite in his justice, were to take on our human condition and then live out a life of human moral righteousness and charity and obedience to reconcile us with God as man and as one who is infinite in goodness and justice. Okay, so Anselm's going to kind of argue this is the way God kind of needs to do things. Once sin has happened, once there's this rupture with God, you kind of need an incarnation to give you infinite righteousness in a human subject, in a subject who's human. And Aquinas can say God doesn't have to do it that way, but there's a certain fittingness to it. More on this in a minute. Okay, so that was a sort of, you know, I ran really kind of quickly through what's actually a kind of major article of Aquinas's on the mode of incarnation. Now, I want to turn to the second question he asked, well, the next article he asked. I want to speak about it briefly. This is a really famous controversy in Catholic theology. Would God have become incarnate had human beings never fallen into sin? So another angle, as it were, on looking at the motives of the incarnation in Christian theology. There is an argument that you find in both Dominicans and Franciscans in the Middle Ages made by St. Albert the Great, who was Aquinas' teacher, a great natural scientist, founder of the University of Cologne. And also made by Duns Scotus, the great Oxfordian Franciscan of the 14th century, that God would have become incarnate even had we never sinned, because in a certain way, the incarnation is the purpose for the creation. I mean, God created the whole world to become human. It's like kind of thinking, if you were to take an image of the universe as a kind of, I don't know what, a piece of jewelry, you know, a beautiful piece of jewelry, lots of parts, you know, the pendant in the middle would be the incarnation. So everything takes on its beauty, its splendor, it's all irradiated by the incarnation. God created the world to become human. It's a really beautiful idea. But St. Bonaventure, who's Franciscan, contemporary of Aquinas, and St. Thomas take a different stance, which is to say it seems from looking at Scripture that God became human principally as a response to human sinfulness. And that's where he, what he says here is, he basically expresses a principle here of epistemological modesty. So he says some people think, in the first paragraph there, he says some people think one thing, some people think the other. He says, but here, look at, this is the second paragraph. Such things as spring from God's will and beyond the creature's due can be made known to us only through being revealed in the sacred scripture in which the divine will is made known to us. In other words, he's saying, look, if you want to answer this kind of question, you've got to look at what God's actually revealed, because he could have done, we don't know what God would have done had we not sinned. We don't really know enough about God to have that kind of information. We're not in a position to have a comprehensive knowledge. And there's a little warning here. It's a very traditional Dominican theological idea. Don't do theology of hypothetical counterfactuals. Like, where would Adam and Eve, I won't get into questions of the historical fall issue, but let me just put it in the kind of straightforwardly biblical way. Where would Adam and Eve have settled had they never sinned? Well, obviously the French Riviera. I know that. I've been to the French Riviera. My cousin lives in the French Riviera. We would all live on the French Riviera. It's fun to say, but of course, and it's a silly example, but there's actually a lot of rather more serious thought experiments like that in history of theology. And Aquinas is sort of saying, you don't know. You really don't know what would have been or could have been unless God has revealed it to you. And he says, hence, since everywhere in sacred scripture the sin of the first man is assigned as the reason of the incarnation, it's more in accordance with this to say the work of the incarnation was ordained by God as a remedy for sin, so that had sin not existed, the incarnation would not have been. And yet, God's not limited in his power. Even had sin not existed, God could have become incarnate. And you say, well, okay, St. Thomas, that's very modest of you. But wouldn't it be nice to believe in that beautiful jewelry analogy that Father White was just making a moment ago, and that the incarnation is like this beautiful kind of central mystery of creation? Well, Aquinas, it's harder to put it in an image, but Aquinas has an equally beautiful idea, which is the ultimate reason for the creation of the world is the Trinity itself, God himself. So Aquinas thinks God made the world not primarily to become incarnate in it or to become human, but God made the world so that we could enjoy God, that we could enjoy the blessedness and the happiness of God and learn who God was. That's different than God becoming human. It's not opposed, but it's very different. And so it's a different point of accent. And you have a lot of theological ink spilled over that debate between these different viewpoints. Now, you do get later, Aquinas has later commentators who say, okay, fine. God, the creed says, for us men and for our salvation, he came down from heaven. That's the Nicene Creed. So it says right in the creed, God became incarnate for our salvation. But you have commentators say, yeah, but I mean, look it. If God becomes incarnate in a certain way, it's a better world than if he didn't. And God wouldn't have created the world without wanting or intending in some way to do something more noble or better. So can you say that God became incarnate because of human sin and yet has, in a way, because of the incarnation, made the world better despite sin, or maybe in a way as a response to sin, made the world better than it ever would have been in the first place? So then you have another theological argument. Because other people say, well, wait a minute now. I mean, the history of human sinfulness, I mean, have you read the Gulag Archipelago? Do you know a little bit about, like, Auschwitz? There's a lot of things that have happened in the human race, and even that happen that are much more, you know, hidden or conventional, that are very painful. And so you don't want to kind of instrumentalize evil as a kind of happy fixture of creation that allows us to have the beautiful incarnation come about. Right? On the other hand, it is true, like, that if God has become human, that's extraordinarily magnificent. And it's, you know, it is arguably the greatest thing that's ever happened. And if it's real still in the resurrection, then if Christ is real, then that's the greatest reality there is. So these are interesting questions to think about theologically. All right. We are not quite approaching the runway, but we're at that point in the airplane ride where the stewardess tells you that you're in a few minutes going to need to close your laptop computer. I'm just saying that to give you hope. I'm not going to land the plane yet, but we've made it two-thirds of the way through our journey. Okay, how does the incarnation relate to the mystery of the atonement? Now, I'm skipping way ahead here to question 46. This is like hundreds of pages later in Summa. And Aquinas is asking about whether it's fitting that God should suffer human death. Now, evidently, the logic here is connected. God becomes human, and God doesn't wave the proverbial magic wand over the world to remake all of God's broken toys so that we all snap to attention, start doing what we're supposed to be. He actually gets into the thick and drama of human history and experiences unjust rejection, arrest, torture, mockery, shame, and execution. All right, so that's a very strong traditional Christian claim that God underwent human death, and not any kind of death, but a pretty grievous one with a high degree of suffering. So in this question, I'm just giving you objection three and response to objection three because they're really interesting. I think really beautiful. So he objects in the Aquinas always gives objections and responses. I've cut a lot of those out, but you know, sometimes they're really the more interesting part of the article. So he says in objection three, further as it's written, so was it necessary for Christ to suffer? Well, you know he's going to say it's fitting. It's only fitting. But it's fitting why? Well, he says, as it's written, all the ways of the Lord are mercy and truth, but it's not seemed necessary that he should suffer on the part of divine mercy, which he bestows, which as it bestows gifts freely, so it appears to condone debts without satisfaction. So what he's saying is, it's not really very merciful for God to become human and suffer as a way to save us, because if God's really merciful, he can just forgive us. He doesn't have to go through all the drama. We don't need the drama of the passion and death of Christ. We can just have, you know, an expedient, efficient, divine mercy. All right. But then he turns around, like almost like schizophrenic, and says, but on the part of justice, it's also wrong, according to which man had deserved everlasting condemnation. Right. So just let them go. They're not interested in you. Let them go. That's real justice. And God, by saving the human race or inviting the human race to salvation, has like foregone real justice. Right. So it's sort of wimpy justice. Justice rendered impure by a problematic mercy. Okay. Reply to objection three. That man should be delivered by Christ's passion was in keeping with both his mercy and his justice. So he's going to double down and he's going to say they each enrich each other. With his justice, because by his passion, Christ made satisfaction for the sins of the human race. Now, the word in Latin there is satisfactio. Which is not like we, you know, like I'm thirsty. Okay, can you give me some Gatorade? Yes, thank you for the Gatorade. Now I've sated my thirst. I'm satisfied. That's not medieval satisfactio. Medieval satisfactio is like, to give a kind of mundane example, you're dating someone and you just say something really gauche about your, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend's father at the dinner table, and then you realize it was really kind of idiotic. So then you don't just write a text, but you actually go to their house and you say, you know, I really apologize for that. That was really inappropriate. That's making satisfactio. That's like, it's rapprochement in the order of justice. It's what is called in a more formal way, atonement. And atonement in English just means, is an English word, not a Latin word, atonement. It's a medieval English word, early modern or late medieval English word, at-one-ment, to unite, right? To be reunited with someone is to make atonement. Okay, so it's in keeping with justice because by his passion, Christ made atonement for the sin of the human race. He reconciled us to God, and so man was set free by Christ's justice. Now, that's a nice image. So for Aquinas, justice is not like some strange, bizarre American Stoic idea of law and order. It's justitia is recovering the really deep order of things. So like when you recover friendship with someone who you're estranged from and there's a reconciliation in charity and love, that's like putting order, deep down order back in things. That's like justitia is a dimension of that. So God has put order back in the world through the atonement of Christ by uniting the human race to himself. And it's in accord with his mercy, for since man of himself could not satisfy for the sin of all human nature, as was said above, God gave him his son to satisfy for him, or to make atonement for him. And I'm going to skip the important biblical tent peg there, where he shows you it's biblical. He then adds this interesting idea. And this came of a more copious mercy than if he had forgiven sins without the atonement. So what he's saying to you is, it is more merciful for God to communicate to you the justice of Christ than if God were to just forgive you without giving you justification or atoning justice in Christ. Because the thing is that as people who need to be in a certain right relationship with God but don't have, as it were, from ourselves the power to get there, by living in the grace of Christ, we're given something that's like much more emboldening, much more liberating, because we actually are able to claim to be part of the very justice or right, the mysterious, it's a mystery, but the mysterious righteousness of Christ. So Aquinas doesn't think like the righteousness of Christ is something locked behind a glass case, like that strange toy store at the base of, in Manhattan, at the base of Park Avenue or whatever it is. You know, I don't remember that name, that weird toy store with all the toys that cost like $3,000 each. Yeah. But you know, you walk by there and you think, who buys this stuff now? Maybe all of you are buying it. But if you are, you're not living on my mendicant salary. And but that's not what Aquinas actually paradoxically doesn't think that's the case with Christ's own righteousness. He actually thinks it's something that can be, as it were, deployed in our own fragile human nature. And that this is actually more merciful, that God would allow us to partake of Christ's justice, which of course he thinks we have principally through the sacraments. All right, last, let's just turn briefly to the problem of evil. Why does moral and physical evil exist in the world after the incarnation? Aquinas doesn't ask this question quite as directly as I did in the bold print. He states it in a more discreet way in the question on baptism. This is later on in the treatise on Christ and the sacraments, where he asks whether baptism should remedy all the ills of this life. Otherwise said, if this is all real, how come people who are conformed to Christ in the sacrament of baptism are still subject to the ills of this life? He says, baptism does have the power to take away, you say penalties, that's another bad English translation, or questionable one, pene in Latin. Duresses, the duress that's happened because of the fall. Right, so all the problems of the human condition that stem in part from the misuse of human freedom. So penalties doesn't mean our own guilt. It could be a pene, could be something you endure because of something else that someone else did that's left you in a condition that you're innocent, you have innocently inherited. But anyway, baptism has the power to take away all the sufferings or the pene of the present life, yet it does not take them away during the present life, but by its power they will be taken away from the just in the resurrection. Okay, so here he goes directly to what we would call eschatology, the last things, the question of God's redemption of the world. But then he gives reasons. Why doesn't God zap us with the magic wand and make all the problems go away? First, because by baptism, man is incorporated in Christ and is made his member by grace, living in the grace of Christ. Consequently, it is fitting, there's that conveniens again, that kind of beauty of what God does. There's a kind of mysterious beauty that what takes place in the head in Christ should also take place in the incorporated member. Now, from the very beginning of his conception, Christ was full of grace and truth, yet he had a body capable of suffering, which through his passion and death was raised up to a life of glory in the physical resurrection. Wherefore, a Christian receives grace in baptism as to his soul, but he retains a body subject to suffering, that he may suffer for Christ therein. Yet at length he may be raised up to a life of impassibility. Impassibility doesn't mean non-emotional frozenness. It means a life where you're ontologically incapable of being further subject to suffering, and where the psychological, spiritual, and physical suffering of this life is no longer has power or duress over the person. So he's saying there's like a mystery of Christological conformity. Grace invites us to be conformed to the mystery. So God, if you go back to the logic of the incarnation, God became human in part so that he could unite himself to us. And we could, in and through all the kind of drama of life, live in the core of our person, in the spiritual faculties of the soul, particularly through faith, hope, and charity, with Christ in the Christian life. He then talks about how that invites us to a life of spiritual training. Namely, in order that by fighting against concupiscence, that's another Latin word, concupiscentia, it's lust, but it's also possessiveness, it's like disordered love. It's a kind of broad word that means like having your heart be all over the place and not exactly in the right place. And other defects to which he is subject, man may receive the crown of victory. So here's the idea that like
what Christ has brought into the world in the incarnation is he's communicating to us the grace to make it possible to live a life of genuine virtue and charity and love in the world, in a world even in which there's a great deal of evil, and even in ourselves in which there's a great deal of struggle. So there's a kind of realism to Aquinas. There's plenty of reasons you can object to Christian eschatology or, you know, Christian belief. But Aquinas is not, I mean, people in the Middle Ages, of course, die younger. Death's a very public thing the way it isn't for us. They're realists. They see the body dies. They know that the Christian faith is a kind of journey of living in view of the life of God, with hope in the life of the soul after death, but also hope in the power of the resurrection vis-a-vis human flesh and human mortality. And then thirdly, he says, I like this last argument, which is from Augustine in the City of God. Lest men might seek to be baptized for the sake of impassibility in the present life, freedom from suffering, and not for the sake of the glory of life eternal. Now, Augustine says, why don't you just get baptized and not die? Why wouldn't God do that? Like, Christ comes into the world, he's resurrected from the dead, go and baptize all the nations, you go baptize somebody, and they're immediately immortal. He says, well, first of all, everybody would line up, you know, if you get baptized immediately, and the only motive would be freedom from suffering. I mean, the primary motive. He says the mystery is different than that because the mystery, consent to the mystery, is fundamentally motivated through free will consent. So this is the kind of free will argument you find in Augustine, that the mystery is present among us but not meant to be so evident and overpowering that it controls consent or that it compels consent by violence. And so this is the idea that grace is real, but grace is an invitation to which one consents freely. Pascal uses a similar kind of argument in the Pensées. He says that for those who do not wish to find the light, they can absolutely freely evade it. But for those who wish to find it, signs are never lacking. So Aquinas, interestingly here, has this kind of argument that baptism is about a kind of mystery of discretion. And if you're, especially if you're from the Protestant tradition, you'd be interested to see that there's something here very strong about the merit of faith. You know, to believe in God, to believe in Christ is meritorious. Well, okay, Protestants didn't talk about merit of faith. I understand Luther doesn't like merit language. But if you think about justification by faith, the emphasis is on the righteousness of the soul exists in part because of the kind of covenant bond with God in faith. And both Luther and Aquinas talk about faith as a kind of marriage of the soul to God, a fidelity. You know, so there's a kind of drama of fidelity of the soul to God through life. In faith, which has to be, you know, engaged in with freedom. Okay, I kind of obeyed. That's really rare when a Dominican doesn't speak too long, and since we started a little late, I did kind of go 45 minutes. So what we'll do is, I believe we're going to take a break for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
People can stretch, people can escape, but if you come back, we will. It'll be quod libital, meaning, you know, you can just ask whatever you're interested in, and we'll try to pursue the conversation further. Thank you very much. Take questions now. I think I'll just take my own questions. Chris gave me permission to take my own questions. There are no bad questions. If it seems patently unclear, just ask it to explain it.
I appreciate your talk and explanations. I'm wondering two things. One, do you have a YouTube channel? And two, if you have any good resources for, I guess, getting this depth.
We paid him.
When does the pizza arrive? Yeah, so the Thomistic Institute, which I'm the director of, we have, like, I think 140 academic talks this year across the country. We put them all up on SoundCloud, audio, so you can listen to it during your commute. So if you put in Google, which that's a very knowledgeable thing, Google, if you put in SoundCloud and Thomistic Institute, it spits up our thing right away. And if you go on there, although it's a little bit loosely organized, there's a gazillion talks on there. Many on philosophy and aesthetic subjects, arts, as well as theology. If you want to subscribe to our, if you go to ThomisticInstitute.org and you join our mailing list, or if you register here, I think you'll also be added. There's a lot of events happening in this area besides events at Rutgers. There's also a lot of events in New York, including on Saturdays. If you want to read about Aquinas, The best book to get into the Summa is written by a professor of theology at Loyola, Maryland, named Fritz Bauerschmidt. He may go by Frederick. But you will find it on Amazon. He told me it's put braces on the teeth of all his kids. Now, he calls it holy teaching. That's his way of translating sacra doctrina, or sacred doctrine, which is a first question of the Summa Theologiae. What is sacred doctrine? What is theology and science? And what Fritz has done is not the whole Summa Theologiae. He took it's like the greatest hits of the Summa Theologiae for Fritz. It's his favorite, not mine. I like some of it the same. I don't like all the same. But he translates it in ordinary American standard English parlance, and he has extremely clear footnotes. I gave this the year I taught at Providence College undergraduates, and they were all complaining after 2 months about any of the other theological readings, because they said, why can't we read that clear stuff of the Bauerschmidt, which is, you know, so in other words, 18-year-olds found it accessible. I like it. I don't agree with him reading the five ways at all. Fritz, are you listening? I think you're wrong. They're not just arguments from fittingness. They're demonstrations. But anyway, he's got controversial readings and everything, but it's an extremely good book. So that's the best way to get into the theology of Aquinas if you want to just read Aquinas. And I don't know, for the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas, well, we have a lot of suggested readings on our website of things to read. But one of the reasons I usually do this kind of talk on this subject of Aquinas is that this first question of the third part is very accessible. If you went and read it now, you'd find it, you know, you'd know what was going on, I think. Unlike some of the metaphysical things, or like what he says about, you know, human freedom, often you need a guide or a mentor to get through Aquinas, in my experience.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask what Thomas Aquinas' opinion is, as well as your own, on the question of whether the second person of the Trinity is eternally the Theanthropos. Because it sounds like, you know, by saying the incarnation is not strictly necessary, that he's not. But then, would that constitute a, you know, change in the nature of God?
Yeah. Well, okay, so it's a couple of different things to say. That's a massive and very interesting question. I'm very interested in the metaphysics of the incarnation, and I've written some things on that. And it's sort of endlessly interesting. But let me just say a couple of things. So, first of all, for Aquinas, it is absolutely clear that the humanity of Jesus is not eternal, and that God became human at a given point in time, and therefore you might say God is contingently human in the sense that God wasn't always human and became human. Secondly, he thinks the humanity of Jesus in the resurrected state, although altered by the power of God, still is utterly human and persists forever. So God will always be human now. God was not always human, but God will always be human now. And thirdly, I think technically Aquinas would distinguish between what pertains to the humanity of Christ as perpetually true of God's humanity, the perpetuity of the humanity of Christ, from the divine eternity. I think for Aquinas, technically speaking, only the divine nature is eternal. Because the way he defines eternity is that there's no temporality because of a sort of plenitude of activity or perfection of life. And that can't be true of things that are finite, and the humanity of God is finite. I mean, Jesus in his human nature he has a creative human nature, and it's finite. The one who is human is also God, and by virtue of being God, he's also infinite. And you say, well, how can God be both infinite and finite? Because God can be both God and human. So Aquinas is going to go down that road. And I think eternity is, he has a certain perdurance in being by virtue of his humanity. And he subsists in an eternal way that's proper to God by virtue of his divinity. Does on that account, the nature of God need to change by virtue of the incarnation? And Aquinas clearly thinks not. But that rather God's, you might say, unchanging plenitude of subsistent life is manifest to us through the contingency and finitude of his humanity. so that God can manifest to us who the Eternal Word and Son really is. God can manifest to us his own identity, you might say, in and through the fragile medium of our humanity, without ceasing to be God, or in any way being changed, altered, or diminished in his own eternal identity. Now, you know, that presents all kinds of challenges. We start with question one in the Church of Bars. Question two, question three, question four, question five, question six are all about that. And he posits things called, he calls mixed relations, which I like to call ontologically non-reciprocal relations, which is like that the humanity of Jesus is, for Aquinas, utterly ontologically relative to his divine identity. So that everything he does as man and everything he suffers as man is relative to his divine identity and personality and is expressive of his divine identity. So when Christ suffers, it is the Son of God who suffers. It's the eternal Word who suffers. It manifests the Word's identity. But the relativity is not non-reciprocal, so that when the Son of God suffers, you don't have to posit that the God suffers in his deity. The sort of plenitude of life that's indiminishable remains undiminished, even in the crucifixion. So this is sort of Aquinas' account. Good book on that is, if you want to look at Aquinas' account, Michael Dodd's The Unchanging God of Love, I think it's called. On the metaphysics of the Incarnation, I have in my book, The Incarnate Lord, a chapter on that. So there's a new book out by Michael Gorman, who's an analytic philosopher at the Catholic University of America, on the metaphysics of the Incarnation. Yes, sir.
So I'm curious about what I think I'm seeing kind of a tension between what went on in the first question where he's giving the reasons for the incarnation, and then the second question where we ask about what if it'd been just sin?
Yes.
Where it looks like you've got at least five reasons in the divinizing side of the table.
Yeah.
That look like pretty good reasons for an incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
That have nothing to do with sin, and then you maybe got a couple of others on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got Aquinas coming and saying, you know, without sin, we should probably say that there wouldn't have been an incarnation,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of edging towards Anselm in that he's assigning the redemption from sin so much of a proportion of the justifying power to the incarnation that if it's gone, you've got to say that there wouldn't have been an incarnation, and that seems odd to me.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, theologians have to kind of keep in tension a lot of different truths that are compatible, but that could, if often hardened, can stand in not just tension, but incommensurability with one another. And the question is, does Aquinas' account, I like what you said just now about the fact that the five, you know, primary reasons for the advancement of the good might seem to work quite well independently of whether we did ever sin, so they would seem to mitigate maybe against the argument in the second part. Now, to his defense, and I'm not saying this is a knockdown argument, but to his defense, he also, in other parts of the Summa, has analysis of the human condition before and after sin that is deeply complementary to both those articles and that helps alleviate the tension. Because Aquinas thinks that part of the effects of original sin is that one of the effects of sin in the human person, original sin, the fallen condition, which was for Aquinas, original sin is primarily an aboriginal loss of grace. You know, the human condition, our human nature, we've lost friendship with God by grace. And then he thinks human nature is kind of disoriented without grace. And spirit kind of falls into subservience to matter and sensation to an excessive degree. Obviously, famously, Aquinas is an Aristotelian. He thinks the body's good. He thinks matter's good. He thinks the senses are good. And he thinks the emotions are good. But they can become, they're not the highest good. And they can become overly fascinating and kind of preoccupying and all-encompassing for the human soul, so that basically you can just live for the visible world alone. So that the incarnation and the sacraments have a kind of healing effect as well as an elevating effect. So I think in the divinization section, he's thinking partly about the fact that they're healing. Incarnation and the sacraments are healing remedies to a disoriented spiritual animal, often immersed in its senses, trying to figure out it's kind of disoriented as to its purpose. That doesn't mean that he's got the right account or there's no problems, but I think that takes some of the pressure off the tension you quite rightly note I'll take your question in a second, Chris. Let's go over.
Okay, so I'll go back to the theme of human simplicity, which you sort of touched upon earlier.
Yeah.
So incarnation as such does not conflict with divine simplicity. What about atonement? So what happens in atonement? Does that somehow change?
Yeah, I actually don't think I mentioned divine simplicity. I think I mentioned divine eternity. But you're right. They're connected. And I think what you're asking is, for Aquinas, does the Paschal mystery, especially the intense personal human suffering that God undergoes in the Passion and in the crucifixion and in his death, affect the divine nature per se? Okay, so Aquinas doesn't hearken on this theme in a particularly long and developed way, but he's fundamentally in the line of thinking of Cyril of Alexandria and Leo the Great, both who he would read not in tension but in continuity. And so he is going to say that, like, God the Word personally suffers, so that when Christ is crucified, God is crucified. When Christ dies, it's the one who experiences human death is God. But then you're going to get that language that's going to be typically initiated, certainly from the time of Leo the Great, and so-called the Tome of Leo, of saying that the single subject, I mean, Aquinas is definitely follows the Council of Ephesus, but he's in single subject Christology, but the single subject, who is the Word made flesh, suffers death by virtue of his human nature, and is impassable by virtue of his divine nature. So just as by virtue of his human nature he can experience helplessness or powerlessness at the cross, by virtue of his divine nature he can say to the good thief, "Today you will be with me in paradise," or he can actively redeem the world. So Aquinas doesn't think that generates mutually contradictory propositions, because you're always qualifying the attribution of the properties of humanity and divinity to the one subject according to a distinctive nature. And so the Chalcedonian Christology allows you to do that. And the pattern there is set out by Cyril and Leo, and Aquinas follows in it, and it feels relatively serene about it. I think that in the contemporary context where you have so much passibilist theology, Thomists or those who want to defend these claims need to do more to show how this, if this account's defensible, how does it allow you to speak to some of the concerns of passibilists about God's solidarity with us in human suffering, about how the suffering of Christ reveals God or reveals the Trinity, reveals the relationships of the persons. You know, so I think you need to generate, in a Thomistic vein, some. But although the people do that, I mean, there are people who work on those topics. Yes?
Is there a problem following out of that? If you think the divine individual, the suppositum, as it were, is not the same as the nature, is that going to lead to any problem with the distinction between essence and existence, or the conflation of essence and existence? Or is the suppositum a completely different individuality? The hypostasis is a completely different thing from that.
When you say individual, right? So, I mean, in one sense, Aquinas thinks this is he's asking a high metaphysical question of Trinitarian theology and of incarnation, theology of incarnation. So in one sense, Aquinas is going to say, if God is simple, there's not a distinction in God between individual and natural kind. Now, this is like, you know, are we all human beings in here? Okay, I'm an individual human being, you're a individual human being, are we all individual human beings? Yes, absolutely. So, can one of us stand up and say, I am humanity? Well, no, we would probably ask that person to see someone. professional. But it's not true to say that of the divine nature that God would say, well, I'm just one God among many. Right? In monotheism, the claim is there's only one who has deity. There's only one who is God. Right? So Aquinas wants to say there's not a real distinction of individuality and essence in God the way there is in us. As if God, there were many gods and God was one individual. The God of the Bible is one individual instantiation of a wider network of individuals we call gods. No, there's just one who is God and who gives being to all others, and all the rest of us are actually individuals of various kinds. Many orange trees, many human beings, many armadillos. And then you get the problem is, well, what about the, you know, individual persons of the Holy Trinity? Because you just said there's only one who is God, and now you're saying the one who is God subsists in three different ways. And I think that's where you have to generate an account of the Holy Trinity. Like, how do we speak about the three persons in a way that respects the revelation of the threefold distinction of persons, and yet claims each of them possesses the fullness of the divine nature, which is that one divine nature I've just been talking about. And then you have to get into the metaphysics of, for Aquinas, subsistent relations, that each person possesses all that he is from or for others in utter relationality, and has the plenitude of the divine nature from others. And there's a lot of apophaticism in that account. There's a lot we cannot know or say about God, but then there are clear things we can say to distinguish how the three persons are each the one God, and there is one God who is three persons. And you can still maintain that non-distinction of individuality and essence that pertains to the divine nature. This is not a typical question I get, but actually I get this question from Dominicans at the House of Studies all the time, so it's nice to be held to a high standard. Hopefully the beginning. You have to go down. I mean, there's a lot of, as he knows, there's a lot of, it's a much larger account that can be given here. Yes, sir.
So I was going to ask about the last part.
The evil part.
Yeah, so this is more of a kind of invitation to say more about the first sort of reason why baptism doesn't remedy all the ills of this life.
In this life.
So the idea is that Christ experienced suffering, and then somehow that's supposed to give us a reason, God a reason to allow us to continue to experience suffering rather than to just heal us completely so that we're not capable of any more suffering as if we were in heaven already. I guess I'm wondering if you can elaborate more on what's the good that's being achieved?
I don't know. I mean, I think of it partly in terms of the fact that if God is real and if Christianity is true, and there's clearly still a lot of things in the world that are totally unredeemed. And yet there is, I think it really is, I think human beings are animated by ferocious hope. I mean, you can meet people who have basically no metaphysical expectations of the universe. It's very hard for them to deny the deep wellsprings of hope that animate them. You know, just sort of really thoroughgoing despair is hard to muster, even though there's some heroic attempts in the 20th century world of French philosophy. So if there's a way in which this like hopeful aspiration towards ultimately religious horizons of meaning is intelligible and it's answered in terms, or has some kind of answer in terms of Christianity, clearly what God is not doing is stopping the story as it goes forward. I mean, there's kind of some kind of aboriginal calamity in the human race, to use Newman's phrase, where we don't get it right. And God doesn't wipe us out. The sort of Noah story, I think, is a symbolic narrative portrayal of that God doesn't wipe us out. But, I mean, nor would I think God ever would wipe us out. I don't think that's the way God is at all. But he doesn't also fix everything in some automatic sort of way. So instead, he enters into the drama of human freedom contingency and the messiness of human political life and becomes actually a victim rather than a victor. And that seems to then set a pattern that, you know, you see reproduced in the Acts of the Apostles, where the heroes of the nascent Christian movement are themselves basically little by little put to death. And they're seen as heroes of faith, fidelity, and the triumph of charity in the midst of that. You know, so the pattern from the beginning is a slightly paradoxical one. Part of the reason I think it works for Aquinas is I think it would for most of the classic Christian people, Augustine and Gregory of Nazianzus and such, is they have a really strong belief in the spirituality of the human soul. So they do think like life in time is never going to fully satisfy, physical life in time is never fully going to satisfy the animating desires of the human heart and mind. So we're really made somehow we're not just made to live in the horizon, of the boundaries and horizon of this life. So I think that partly is that, you know, it's like the spirituality is like, it's a calling to follow Christ. It's like a calling to elevate the self toward a kind of higher life under grace. But maybe you seem to, you're frowning, so you must have other arguments that I have not generated that you want to kind of make here. No?
Well, I'm just thinking, so if what you're saying is the spiritual life is so important, then why is it important that, Stephen gets baptized, and why is it so important that he goes on to lead a life of suffering and ultimately death?
As you guys know, I mean, there's people like Richard Swinburne who argue that suffering is like always a kind of occasion for moral heroicism. And I'm a little nervous about, I mean, it's sort of famous how he sort of makes some of those arguments and people find them quite controversial, questionable. I'm nervous about too easily or too quickly generating arguments for moral improvement from confrontation with suffering, partly because in my own life as a priest, I just see a ferocious amount, a rather intensive amount of suffering. I do think it does, I do think most people, if they're, I mean, I'm speaking out pastorally, I think when people suffer intensively, if they do so with faith in Christ and they do so in friendship with God, it does lead them to a better kind of life with God over time, where it does have elevating features. But it's really hard to look at that from the outside, or sometimes to endure it from the inside in one's own life, and say that this is evidently beneficial. You know, so I think you got to be really careful about that. At the same time, whether or not any of this is true or well argued, we are going to suffer intensively. The human race is suffering. So, you know, having a strategy to think about what you're going to do with your suffering is wise. And obviously Buddhists have another one, and, you know, people who like gin and tonics a lot have another one. And I think there are a lot of really defensible strategies, but I think ultimately, you know, Christianity is the most, I think, the most plausible. I mean, obviously, I'm a good Catholic priest. I don't think gin and tonics and Christianity are radically I think there is intelligibility. There is intelligibility, and practically speaking, I see that it works to live through suffering as a Christian, but I don't like fitting it too tightly into a rational kind of argument. I don't know if that's really a very helpful thing to say to philosophers, but I know you're going to ask me more about this later, but let me just go ahead and make sure. I'm going to have to take one or two more questions.
Yes, sir. Well, actually, I kind of like to follow up on that.
That's fine.
Yeah. Well, what you said about the idea of Christian suffering, you know, take up your cross, right, which is a very common concept. There are many Christian devotional texts like the Imitation of Christ or Abandonment to Divine Providence,
mm-hmm.
which seem to give an approach where what happens, the suffering that happens to us, kind of transcends a person, right? Which can make it seem like there's a problem with the relationship between the cross and faith as a way to transcend suffering. So if here it says that the ultimate end is impassibility, how is it that some devotional texts speak of, you know, not being faded by the suffering, but also take up your cross? Because if a person develops the ability to not be faded by it...
Dominicans tend to be, because of our Ursuline tradition, tend to emphasize the goodness of life in the body and the fact that a lot of the evil that happens because of divine permissions, and not God's executive will, so that it's stupid to say to people, this is only happening to you because God really wants it to, and you can say, no, God just does mysteriously permit or allow a lot of things to happen. So we make a lot of distinctions. What the Dominican tradition is not as prone to is just saying kind of like, this is the cross that God has willed for you to embrace as a way to move vertically up into the mystery of the crucifixion and to love God. So there are times where that is prudentially, it seems like, the answer of what God is doing in a person's life, and it is sometimes the thing to say to people. It is helpful to give a couple pastor examples. I was my first summer as a priest, I was at Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York, which, you know, is a hospital for people dying of cancer, and my third day on the job, I went to see a woman who was from New Jersey. She was about 50-something, and she was with her two teenagers and her husband, and she when I came in the room, she said, she
said to the nurse, could you leave for a minute so I can talk to the priest alone? And she said to me, the doctors are saying there's nothing else they can do for me. I'm a 50-year-old woman in the prime of my life. I've got everything to live for. I feel I'm a Catholic my whole life. But I feel like God has abandoned me and I have nothing. And I'm just dying. It's meaningless. What do you think? I've been a priest for like 2 weeks, right? So I decided not to reinvent the wheel. And I said, I'm going to tell her what Mother Teresa says. I said, you know, Teresa of Calcutta says that our sufferings can become the opportunities for a conformity to Christ crucified and for our living in grace and union with Christ, and it brings life to others and it brings grace to the world. And it's kind of emotional, remember, I'm sorry about that. That's not pre-planned. But, and I said, you know, your experience of death is going to bring grace to your whole family, and it's going to bring you in deep alignment with the mystery of Christ crucified and God. So, you know, I'm writing blank checks for God here. I'm just saying, I mean, I believe it, you know, but I'm just saying things that I think Mother Teresa says that are helpful. And she, you know, she said, Father, that's helpful, thank you. And there were some other things, some sacramental things, and I left. So I couldn't come back the next day, but I went to check back over 2 days later, and I came back, and she had died. So that, you know, that's the kind of thing where you sort of say, you know, that is very absolute in terms of what a human being lives in death. And I do believe that in that case, you know, that God, you know, allowed a priest to be there for that person in that moment. So I think that those are sometimes the way things, the stories unfold.
I'd just like to echo that, because I was the wife in that, in a similar setting. I had an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old, and my husband died of cancer and a very horrible death, as all cancer deaths are. And these priests were there for me.
Good philosophy is real. I mean it's
right,
the same thing,
false.
You know.
I guess that's they don't come from the thinking part. They come from the human part. And they mean a lot.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for that. I mean, that's very encouraging to me that you would give such a concrete example in response. I think that what I'm trying to say here is that I do think that is this livable? Well, I have seen people live it. You know, that's really in cases like that, you sort of see the fortitude of the faith in the human life. Okay. I will continue to take questions, and anybody can come up also and ask afterwards. I do feel like I should liberate you. You've been extremely patient and very generous. So thank you so much for your help.